Art Papers expands the dialogue around contemporary art and culture by exploring the ways they affect and reflect human experience. You can find a rich archive of interviews, reviews, feature essays, artist projects, and more on artpapers.org. Welcome to this month's episode of Echoes, a monthly series where we spotlight our community of contributors, writers and artists who've been central to Art Papers' creative and rigorous coverage over the years. This month, we have a dialogue between Jean Moreno and Stephanie Bailey discussing resilience and resistance and other overlapping ideas surrounding our spring 2024 theme, Reworlding. If you haven't already, check out Stephanie's feature, How to Make the Old World New, Notes on Whales in the Room, and Jean's Imagination Dead Imagine on artpapers.org. The works they're discussing are linked in the description, and there's also a link if you'd like to support the work of Art Papers by making a donation or purchasing from our shop.
Well, I mean, just to, as we're waiting, it's so exciting to be part of this contributor conversation. Obviously, you all know this is in the context of the amazing issue that Michael has edited, Jones McKean has edited for Art Papers with the amazing Art Papers team. We have Sarah Higgins, the editor and executive artistic director of Art Papers, with us in this room today as well, and Noah, the wonderful in charge of circulations, a great support. We're very happy to be all here together to think about reworlding. And maybe while I'm waiting for Jean, I mean, one of the things that we talked about was if you guys have any questions, please drop them into the comment section. We're going to keep an eye on it because it would be nice for this to be a bit of a roundtable discussion, no? And what's quite interesting with Jean and Stephanie's text and my own is that while they seem quite like they're very different pieces and they're talking about very different things, there's some very generative overlaps, I suppose, or there's some real like productive gaps between the texts where we do find some synergy. So I'm hoping that we're going to dig into some of those. And maybe in the meantime, while everyone's waiting, because Jean and I have already talked about it, I could probably begin by just introducing my essay. That was the plan. Jean and I discussed it yesterday, and we both said, I think obviously the best way to begin this talk would be to maybe briefly introduce our texts and what we were trying to do with them. So yeah, thanks. Thanks for the prompt. So Reworlding. So this text that I wrote was really a dream for me. It's something I've been wanting to do for a very long time. I think ever since I knew of the story of Moby Dick, and to be honest, I don't remember when I learned of it. It just seems to be a story that has always been known. And I think in certain contexts, you know, the story of Moby Dick, you don't even have to read the book to actually know the story of the whale. And so I've always had it in my mind that, you know, Moby Dick, given the fact that where Moby Dick's story sort of comes within the context of the apex of the Yankee whaling industry, which really sort of lubricated the industrial world during the kind of colonial, like early industrial era, but also the kind of move from a historical colonialism, let's say, to a modern colonialism or towards colonial modernity. Moby Dick, for me, in my imagination, was an anti-capitalist revolutionary who was really kind of fighting back against the occupation of the seas when the oceans were being massacred, the whales were being massacred in the oceans for their blubber. And Moby Dick is actually based on a true story. There wasn't just one fighting whale, there were many fighting whales. And Melville does a good job in kind of giving us a rundown of a few of them. He even goes back to one whale that was in sort of ancient Roman world. So, I became fascinated with this idea of Moby Dick and the whale as anti-capitalist revolutionary, but also thinking about the slaughter of the whales in the oceans during this period of colonial modernity as part of the history of anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist struggle. And what I was saying to Jean was, for me, this text, it's more of an exercise of the imagination. It looks like an academic text. It behaves like one. But in reality, it's a collage. It's a collage of different sources, of different thoughts and different reflections that refer to this question of animal sentience. And I think the question of animal sentience within the context of whales being victims of a capitalist system that has continued on today speaks to this idea of the soul. And one of the things I was thinking about when I was waiting to start this talk today after the conversation I'd had with Jean was that I realized that with Moby Dick is that Moby Dick can be seen as the white whale, right? It's a symbolic, it's sort of an avatar, a symbol as such, but it's also a living thing. And I think the question in this text that I realize it raises is Moby Dick had a soul, or the question of whether an animals have sentience, whether they have an awareness of the world around them, that they're able to emotionally process this world, that they can feel the things that are happening to them, I think speaks to the question of imperialism in the sense that in terms of colonization and occupation, often what is the first to go is the imagination, and to hold space for the imagination is super important. And I think within the context of the world that we're living in now, to hold space for the idea that all living things have a soul or they have sentience opens up the question of what does it really mean to live in solidarity today, and perhaps opens up a horizon a little bit to reimagine what does it mean to live or to create a planetary contract that would take into account that we live in community with all other living things. So that's kind of a summary of my piece. Just really claiming the imagination back. I think imperialism at this point in time is a state of mind, and I think that relates to the question of the whale, because we are really fighting for the soul of our collective existence. So that's it, really. Is Jean with us now? Is Jean in the room? Yay!
Great.
Oh, I did it!
Great.
Well, I just did a terrible attempt at trying to introduce or summarize your text a bit. I've done a little bit of mine.
Okay.
So well, it's all your floor. Floor is yours, Jean.
Yeah. Well, thank you for holding it up till we figure this out. Yeah. So thank you, everyone at Art Papers and Michael, for the invitation to write. This is a co-authored text with Stephanie Wakefield, who I think we should say heroically went through the editing phase while having a baby. So
wow.
That's something. So our text, I think we're looking at, you know, as Michael kind of set up the framework of the planetary, we thought, what does that mean at the level of the city? And since Miami's kind of our theater of operations, we just use Miami. And I think one of the premises of the text is that resilience has become kind of the governing logic of cities. And it's a liberal kind of mode, and it's creating certain subjectivities that we call resilience, the resilient subject. And I think two consequences stem from that, or at least is what the text proposes. One is that the state in such a situation kind of abnegates its role in maintaining a coherent kind of social fabric, right? Because now it has the excuse of having this loftier task of just keeping the city afloat, right? We have to keep the city afloat. We have to keep everyone alive, so that kind of gives it the excuse to not actually have a productive role in maintaining social relations livable. And then the second thing that I think stems from this is that once resilience becomes this dominant logic, then life itself becomes a place of endless precariousness and risk. And if you live in a space of endless precariousness and risk, your survivability becomes the most important aspect of it. And so therefore, you're beholden to find the next short-term solution so you can just survive. Mm-hmm. And I think what this does is it kind of closes future thinking, right? So if we're caught in these boundless end times, this forever unfolding presence of omni-crisis, then how do we think the future from that place? From those two consequences, then we started thinking, what is artworks that use climate as their theme, that are engaged with climate as their main content, and I think what we found is that quite a bit of it sounds a lot like state speak. It's sometimes hard to tell the difference that we get from the resilient officers of the city of Miami Beach and what we get from artists, at least in terms of messaging, maybe at the level of poetics or formal production, they're obviously quite different. Artists, of course, this is what they do. They're quite sophisticated at doing this. But in terms of messaging, it sometimes feels quite similar. And I think the other thing that is concerning a little bit, I think, is that in these works, the state is rarely the enemy, right? These works find their antagonists in either a public that is not quite sensitive yet to the crisis and needs to be educated, or this other group of people who are just kind of blanket climate denier cabal that somewhere exists that then it's not that those people don't exist, it's that they just become this almost like the straw man for these practices. And I think one thing that's important to say is that when we look at this work, it's not what the work says, it's kind of how it functions. And sometimes the effective dimension of this work feels quite similar to the effective dimension of documents that come out from state offices. So I don't know, somewhere in there, that's the gist.
Yeah. One of the things that really struck me about your text, and I realize now that because I'm moderating this live, I can't go off because I took all my notes as screenshots on my phone. So I'm going to have to find a way to paraphrase it. But there's one line where you basically say, yeah, the state and the non-state, counter-revolution and revolution are now working in tandem, right? So it's basically this idea of a closed suit, a dead loop, which is the imagination dead time, right? Mm-hmm. And that's really embodied by the... this all-encompassing logic of urban development, which we see in Miami and Miami Beach especially, right? In Miami Beach, it's almost a kind of death drive that we see with this like incessant development, even with the knowledge that the land is sinking. And we had that awful disaster with that one building, I can't remember, that was near in North Beach, right?
Yeah.
It was awful. And that was interesting to me because it got me thinking about Horkheimer and Adorno when they were talking about the culture industry. And there's one section in the culture industry in one of the essays that they wrote on the dialectics of enlightenment, I think, I can't look at my notes, guys, so you're just going to have to go with me here. But they do talk about how, you know, within the context of the culture industry, this idea of the sameness that happens in the objects also happens in the cities. So even then, at that time, they describe this kind of like gleaming cities rising up and they all look the same. It's this identikit culture. And for me, I think this is where our texts probably meet in the middle, because we're both talking about world system. We're both talking about hegemony.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were talking, you know, you go in the text, you both talk about this concept of Miami forever or forever Miamians. And when I was reading it, I was like, oh, yeah, it's like the empire forever. Do you know what I mean? And we had talked about this earlier, like, it also made me think about how in New York, it really irks me when I see in New York these banners that says NYC, real estate capital of the world, as if this is something to celebrate or a cultural achievement. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about this dead loop, you know, and the title itself of the piece, because I think, you know, earlier when I was introducing my text briefly, I was like, my essay is actually more about the imagination more than anything. And I wonder, I think we probably actually are, both of our texts are actually about the imagination.
I think ours may be a little bit about the danger of foreclosing on the imagination, the imagination of different futures in particular.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Miami Forever was the name of a bond that the city government here had a vote on. And it's $400 million bond on current and future mitigation strategies for climate instability. And so what it's really interesting is that there's so many provisions in the bond for dangers that don't exist yet. And to it's quite interesting to us, I think, that in resilience discourse, this idea of the unknown unknowns that, you know, kind of circulated during the Gulf War.
Donald Rumsfeld, Errol Morris.
Yeah. So it's kind of repurposed in some way. So if you kind of read state documents, they're full of these unknown unknowns for which they need provisions in the present. So that's really interesting in that then we thought, well, what kind of subjectivities are you imagining when you put those provisions? Imagining and producing when you put provisions and when these provisions become such important part of these kind of government instruments. And so we started calling the subjectivity Forever Miamians. And they don't have to be in Miami, they could be anywhere. But the idea is that they're kind of subjectivities organized by climate visualizations, by projective analytics. Like their future is already captured in these I mean, it's not just visualizations, it's also discourses and all these things. So their future is already captured and almost barred, right? So this kind of subjectivity that now just needs to survive and go from one short-term solution to the next and one mitigating strategy to the next and has no capacity or just not given the space in which to think a different world altogether.
So absolutely. I want that idea of time is interesting because I think this speaks to the concept of financial time. And I think that like what you're saying is that, you know, we're lurching from one crisis to another. And I think that in many ways it's because with our time, the mainstream time frame of commerce is the rolling calendar of quarters, right? So it's the quarterly report. And if the quarterly report looks bad, then the shares go down. Do you know what I mean? So it basically engenders a short-term response. It engenders a reactionary system in a way, because you're always going to have to chase the next 3 months. Do you know what I mean? Like in order to affirm your right to be a business or to be in existence or affirm your growth, right? To affirm your life. And I think this is also where we meet, because, you know, when we're talking about Miami, when we're talking about cities, when we're talking about, you know, even if we're talking about communities, we're also talking about economies. So I think that's another, I mean, I guess I've been thinking a lot about where the through lines between our texts, because it's interesting that you said something about this being about the city. You know, your text is very rooted in Miami, whereas with mine, mine is pretty much like all over the earth. In a sense, it's all over the place, right? It's a whale, but it's whales and dolphins and lobsters and beavers and all of us together everywhere all at once. But it's also everywhere all at once in Miami too. In this thinking about, let's say, the culture industry or the world system in which we live, this is a process of evolution that has been going on for centuries. This is where we find ourselves now. And maybe this is why the urgency to open up a space of imagination is so important.
Yeah, I was thinking, so a friend of her name is Natalia Suluaga, who talks about future mining in relation to debt economies. And I think there's some analogy there to be made with this kind of forever Miamian that we're talking about, of this kind of is their future is mined somehow by current real and imaginary current problems or crises. Life kind of pegged to financial times and financial cycles is itself in parallel to kind of life peg to the precariousness of climate instability.
Absolutely. I mean, that was the thing with the whales. The whales were basically the fuel for the entire capitalist industry at a certain point, and actually the age of empire, the early ages of industry and empire. So our current global modernity, as Arif Dirlik would have called it, which emerged through the colonial modernity that was really modernized in the 19th century, is founded on whales, actually, if you think about it, the importance of whale blubber in the 17th and 18th century in particular, and in particular for the American economy. You know, it does always come back down to capital, because effectively this is what the system of modernization was. It was about developing, replicating and establishing a capitalist world system at that time through the colonial impulse to claim and extract everything. So it's an asymmetric system that we're still living in. And then when I'm thinking about that, I think, okay, with the forever Miamians, then I guess in a way Moby Dick is also a bit of a forever Miamian in a way. It just doesn't go away. But then we also talked about this, that it's funny when I think about your text in terms of the microcosm of Moby Dick. It's really an incredible story when you really dig into it. And I think what was so amazing with this text for me was that Moby Dick itself is written as a series of aphorisms in many ways. It's a really beautiful book. You could actually enter the book, I think, in any chapter, and you can still get it. But what was so great is that I feel like this time I read Moby Dick through different reflections on Moby Dick. So it was Wu Tang's film, gorgeous film, really recommend it. Quite a faithful retelling, and there's some beautiful reviews out there of the piece if you want to get a kind of like succinct summary of it. So there was Wu Tang's, and then there was Chuan Andrew Nguyen's beautiful work, My Ailing Beliefs, which I saw at the Berlin Biennial. Anyway, it was just about kind of really trying to find, with this text, I was able to like tell the story and actually read the story of Moby Dick through multiple sources. It was actually a very decentered experience, which I think is quite interesting in the sense that maybe in many ways, Melville's text was also a meta-text. And I think it comes back to this question of dead time and living time, right? So in this, even in the 19th century when Melville was writing Moby Dick is the specter of death that haunts the sailors, but in his embodiment as a spectre of death, he is life itself. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's so powerful about remembering this story now. So, remembering this story now is to think about ourselves as allies in allegiance or in alliance with living things. And of course, I write about this in the essay that, you know, the last few years we've had the orcas attacking boats off Gibraltar, and, you know, dolphins attacking swimmers. And, you know, there's always been on Twitter's like this place that's just really gurning for an animal revolution, which is great. I'm here for that too. But I think it says more about us. It says more about where we are and the need to reconnect, I think, in this way. And then, of course, that comes back to questions of land back, about indigenous rights, about reparations, because effectively, I guess, coming back to your text, we're all living in this system is we're living in the dead time of this historical system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot.
Sorry.
A lot of thoughts. One was, I think resilience discourse is not different from a lot of the things you're saying. I think its ultimate task is to maintain a status quo at the socioeconomic level, while authorizing all kinds of changes at an infrastructure level, including the production of subjects that now become part of that infrastructure. Yeah. So resilience discourse comes with this constant kind of injunction for people to become, to participate and become better at guaranteeing their own survival.
Yeah.
Right? So subjects are supposed to change. They're supposed to take up a bunch of the roles that were supposed to be the states, but the socioeconomic system itself doesn't change. So we change everything else about the city, about ourselves, just so that one basic fact doesn't have to change, right? So Miami Forever means Miami Forever within capitalist relations, right? It's not Miami Forever in a new way.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's why I'm like, oh, so that's why Moby Dick is like Miami Forever, because Moby Dick doesn't go away. Moby Dick, the story just remains. I think I was saying earlier, you weren't here, we're waiting for you to come in, but like, I think there's a reason why. Like, I don't even remember the first time I heard the story of Moby Dick. It's just something I've always known, and I believe in certain contexts, it's just like that for people.
Yeah.
It's just this constant thing that doesn't go away, because Moby Dick is like this shadow of exactly the system that won't change, and it will throw out anything to encourage those within the system to change within themselves, so just so that the system can stay the same. Is that what you're saying as well?
Yeah. And it'll, you know, resilience authorizes quite a lot of demands be put on the subject, right? And very few are put in the kind of economic organization of the world, right?
Yeah.
So you know, things like, you start thinking of things like carbon offsets and all this. This is all like mitigation strategies, less to save the people of the planet and more to save this kind of system that is moving on its own almost. You know, it almost, I mean, if the imagination is now in dead time, then capital relations are almost like in this zombie, cyclical, self-moving motion.
Yeah, totally. Zombie capitalism, effectively.
And I think Moby Dick has always been this kind of, you know, we kind of chatted a little bit a few days ago, and I said that when I read your text, I went back and read C.R.L. James, Mariners, Renegades, and Castaways.
Yeah.
And I think what doing that was helpful was in thinking that I think with art that engages climate, there's got to be more a different politics inflecting it than the politics of just doing that.
Yeah.
Right? There's got to be a politics behind it to do that. And it's just C.R.L. James just makes you think, like, when he comes with a politics and he can read Moby Dick in a new way, right? In a way that is proper for the 1950s, for the emergence of Stalin, for the emergence of the Third Reich, for the rise of a workers' movement that was independent of these kind of state communist empires. So I think this is, it's a little bit like that.
But also the global anti-capitalist movement, you know, the renegades and castaways were all the colonized, effectively, the enslaved, the colonized, and the workers of this imperialist system.
Okay, so Michael seems to have a question.
He's asking you about, he's curious about the provocative Bratton quote that you pull that connects but also necessitates our imagination.
Yeah, I think the Bratton quote has to do with something like we can, a lot of, so we can't imagine a lot of the things that we're talking about without global computation. And I think this is, I think this is right in the sense that I think that, you know, I think in effect we say that if climate is one of the kind of dominating facts that organize contemporary life, global computation is the other one, right? These kind of algorithmic entities are quite impactful, right, in our everyday lives. Then again, and I think that maybe that's a different conversation, but that is also a kind of barring of the future, right? If you think of the way algorithms work, they're kind of collating your data in order to kind of give you what you already like so they can mine your attention, which I think implies a closure of your world, right? There's no accidents to be had. There's no difference that you can move towards when you're kind of in a feedback loop, right? It's almost like you cease to be yourself and you just become this profile that these kind of corporate algorithmic entities capture, right? And just put to work for them, you know, by mining your attention, by making you the sole content producer, right? You just kind of at work for them at all times. In the situation in which starts to also demand from you this kind of endless self-disclosure, right? You kind of have to perform yourself at all times, but it's a bit of a performance without end, right? Without end meaning not both in the sense that it's not finished, but it has no real purpose. You kind of perform yourself at all times.
Yeah, right.
But what are you performing towards? And it's kind of, I would say, might be hard to say what you're performing yourself towards.
But that's interesting, if you don't mind me interjecting, because sure. Mentioning C.L.R. James, like that's what he talks about, and that's what Wu-Tang, the script that was written by Sophia Almeria in Wu-Tang's film, it's narrated by Fred Motton. They quote C.L.R. James, who talks about the plan. But like he says Ahab, the captain of the ship, who is like the totalitarian type, who he compares to the Stalins and the Nazis of the world, who basically plan their economies and build their, you know, but in a way it sort of made me think about Horkheimer and Adorno. Like they it's basically planning your cities, planning your, you know, planning every aspect of life, you know, of the state, the nation state. I just drew a blank actually. Oh no.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the plan.
So he was talking about the plan. He says like Ahab has nothing but the plan itself, and the C.L.R. James even says this about Nazi and Stalin and Hitler. Like it wasn't about dictatorship; it was about the plan. But the plan is abstract, and it has no purpose but the plan itself. So it's this kind of, it's a loop, right? Which is actually what Melville was sort of getting at, also with the microcosm of the Pequod, with the ship as this sort of microcosm of a colonial modernity, of a system of colonial modernity. The floating factory.
Yeah, I think the plan is now what, right? So it's displaced from, right? Like the signifier of the plan is no longer like a figurehead. It's actually like a landscape of interfaces and algorithms, right? But besides generating more corporate power and corporate wealth, that That is the plan, and the plan is just doing that indefinitely forever. Which, I don't know, it seems like we need other futures.
Yeah, so I mean, maybe this helps us move on, because I mean, I think this idea of dead time is countered actually in the context of Moby Dick, and I think, and in my text, what I wanted to do, like, as I said, I wanted this to be a story. So actually the way that it's written, it looks like an academic text, but it's not really. I wanted to draw readers into the story so we could eventually get to that question of what does it mean to imagine new futures, like concrete new futures within this context. And I think that the achievements that have been made in terms of indigenous rights and claiming rights of nature, so Ecuador and Bolivia were the first to enshrine the rights of nature in their constitutions, although there's problematics throughout these, of course, because, you know, how far can you actually enshrine the rights of nature within the constitution of a nation state, which is the basic unit of the colonial modern, right? The nation state, R.F. Derlick famously mentioned, and I recommend anyone to read R.F. Derlick, The Global Modernity. It's an incredible book. The nation state was effectively the instrument of empire in the 19th century. And so it's that question of, you have then examples of indigenous groups, activist groups, trying to use the international legal system, right, which is the thing that binds the international world order together. It's what holds the nation state in many ways. And they try to use that legal system in order to redefine its contract. And I think this comes back to C.L.R. James, because in the 50s and 60s, this was famously the period when, it was the post-war era. Decolonization was in effect. African states were becoming independent, and they were all joining the General Assembly of the UN. And this was truly a revolutionary time, actually. It completely transformed the makeup of the United Nations, which was rooted in white supremacy, actually. And one of the architects of the South African apartheid was actually one of the authors of the co-authors of the UN Charter. He was even responsible for putting the word human rights into it, which is insane. And W.E.B. Du Bois called that hypocrisy out. You know, there's this question, can we do this? Is that old question, right? Can you use the master's tools? And so it's like thinking about that is just one way to think, how could we reimagine our legal system, which is effectively the international legal system that at present is the planetary contract that we currently have. And I think that we can all see what's happened to that planetary contract. It's basically been ripped to shreds in recent times. And then it moves on then to this question of what indigenous communities have been speaking about for a long time, which is about how to recalibrate our relationship to this world, how to recalibrate our relationship to the earth, given the fact that we are living within the structure of its incarceration effectively. And we talked about this a little bit. You know, I saw the amazing show by New Red Order that was hosted by Creative Time in Queens, I think it was last year. It was on Land Back, and it's that question of, there's one of the works they were sort of talking about how indigenous communities in the US, but elsewhere, had experienced their apocalypse already because they had been invaded and their way of living had effectively been destroyed by the enclosure of the land. So, yeah, I mean, I think this relates to the question of future. And actually, I think this also relates to something that we had talked about in terms of, and this relates to what you were talking about with art, the artworks that you mentioned in your text, these climate works, but also the function of text that we write. And, you know, mm-hmm. Where does it go? What is the purpose of all of this, right? And how do you create, how does it move into sort of a concrete flow where we can actually begin to manifest imagination as something that can be real, right? How does imagination become reality in this day and age when everything, and you had a beautiful line about this, and I can't pull it up right now because I'll lose this the window, but this beautiful point where you said we're all just like, you know, we're all in the flow, we're all in the data flow, you know, so we're caught in a flow that won't actually allow us to kind of recalibrate into another. Or go, what is that phrase when you skip into another metaverse or something? Enter a new multiverse?
Mm-hmm. Like a time slip or something?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, to the question of what these texts are for, I mean, for me, I think it's Right, so the temptation is to inflate it, to say that it's like this whatever. And I think it's a much more humble thing, and I think it's an intervention in a particular moment. I think for us, so we try to ground it in the city, talk about things that we see moving in the city and where we think there might be a blind spot. Yeah, so I think it's a bit of a tool for a moment. I don't know that, if different work gets done around this topic in 5 years, maybe this text will be useless, and that's fine. Or maybe this is a text that someone needs to argue against and put it in some kind of exchange and give it a function in that way. But I think, yeah, I think it's a text that intervenes in a moment, and that's what it's for.
Yeah.
I think so. I think one of the things that is behind this text that maybe it's not, it's just what's a lot of what's behind it is that some of the things that we see coming out of Miami, they're very didactic, and I don't want to explain what's going to happen to your house when sea level rises or this or that. And somehow, when you're in the city, it weirdly doesn't feel like that. It's more complicated. Yeah, you know that something's wrong because there's like sunny day flooding, but there's also 20 people making a line in front of the Prada store, right? There's this massive opulence and this crisis coming, and somehow in between those sides is where subjects, in the twist between that, there's a subject being produced in the city, and I think some of the work we see kind of is not true to that fact in some way, right? It's more of a kind of antiseptic didactic proposal, and it's not how it feels living in the city at this moment. So there's something there. I think this is what some of this is also behind this text,
So
the idea of
what would you say would be a counter gesture to that kind of, as you called it, an aesthetic didactic proposal?
don't know. That's for artists to figure out, right?
Well, no, really. I mean, you're writing about it too. We're critics. I mean, we can try. We've got to use our imagination, Gene.
Yeah. Yeah, I just think it's just yeah, there's just it, the city is creepier and more complicated and more twisted up than what feels like that work wants to embody. And I don't know. I mean, I think this is an undercurrent in Miami, right? So in the early 2000s, we had this kind of a whole genre of electronic dance music that was totally tweaked out. And it was, there's, I mean, this is a running theme. We had, the kind of raunchy hip hop comes out of here. So there's, it's a city that is always kind of caught between kind of cross currents. And I think the aesthetic production that comes out of here that manages to embody that seems to be, I don't know if better, but certainly more honest than some of other things that are quite in vogue at the moment. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Maybe we should open the floor.
Yeah, I was going to say we forgot. I had mentioned, I mean, if anyone has any questions, please drop them any thoughts, comments, or if you have something to say, feel free to just drop it in the comments. It would be great to hear your thoughts on things that we've discussed in this conversation on the subject of reworlding based on the issue that Michael Jones McKean has edited online for Art Papers. Michael, wondering about whaling as a possibly accidental vehicle of proto-globalism. Oh, absolutely. They talk about this. I mean, whaling was really the thing that kind of, in it's, I've quoted a couple of people in the text, but it's like whaling was a way that powered the age of different modes, different trajectories of exploration, let's say. And it enabled colonialism to expand. It basically powered colonialism in its early days, the early industrial era, and it peaked in the 18th century, which was really like 1850. It was like the peak of the British Empire or the beginning of its peak. So, absolutely, it was a proto-globalism. I mean, it was globalism even then, really, not even proto. Who said? Gustavo, I hope this is recorded. Okay, thanks, Gustavo. Aw, thanks, Gustavo. Well, you know, let us know if it happens. We'd love to hear what the kids, what the students have to say. Yes. As Sarah said, this video will be saved to the Art Papers Instagram grid, so anyone can access it later. So yeah, coming back, I mean, I think maybe, you know, we're coming up to an hour. Maybe we could go back to what Michael Jones just asked about, Michael Jones McKean, sorry, wondering about whaling as an accidental vehicle of proto-globalism. I don't think it was an accidental vehicle. I think that it was accidental that whales became the main source of fuel at a certain point for light. And light was the main thing. I mean, I think towards the end, whale blubber was really like the high-end material for light because it was so famous for having no smell and it burned cleanly. It was like premium oil, you know, premium oil, premium illumination as such. But I think it just kind of like, you know, coming back to this idea of globalism, I think that, again, as we had mentioned earlier, like, and you talk about this in your text, Jean, that this is a hegemony. We're living in a historical hegemony. Effectively, and that hegemony was established through it's maintained through a system of capitalist production, circulation, accumulation, extraction, but it was established and imposed in the world through colonialism. So that's why, I mean, the final line in my text was, the 19th century whales are part of this history of anti-imperialism. They're as much part of the history of anti-imperialist movements as the non-aligned movement of the 20th century. If we were to understand ourselves in solidarity with other living things that are also being directly impacted, and not just impacted, our entire lives, our souls are being shaped by this system at this point. This is centuries now in the making. What does that do to us? What does that do to your understanding of your place in this world if you understand a whale as your comrade? And I have to say, like, I mean, one of the things when I wrote this text was like, I don't want to be, I'm not being like some, oh no, we shouldn't eat any animals, because this was the kind of thing that a couple of lawyers, there's a text that I referenced by two lawyers about the rights of whales. And one of the paragraphs, the chapters that they have, they were like, oh, well, you know, the indigenous, they also, you know, they talk about their cultural subsistence, but they're a bit skeptical about it. And I think that's a colonial mindset too. I think that we have so much to learn from indigenous people, especially now. And I think it's wonderful that it's becoming more apparent. And this also includes the situation in Palestine as well. So this is why in the end, I quote Noor Erkat, who's a brilliant Palestinian activist and human rights attorney. And she talks about sovereignty, and she talks about how really the real situation right now is that we have to redefine and reacquaint ourselves with this concept of sovereignty, because currently sovereignty is a co-opted idea that has been used to establish the nation state and the supremacy of the border. So Nora talks about sovereignty as a form of collective belonging. If we were to think about collective belonging, of course it becomes a collective responsibility. How do we hold this world? How do we hold ourselves together as everything falls apart? And I think it's so urgent for us to begin opening up these questions and grounding them. So maybe, in terms of these artworks, I mean, maybe this is one stage. I'm very curious to know where this could go. Is it even possible? You know, coming back to your text, I mean, sometimes I think, God, it seems so insurmountable. You look around and it's like these cities. I felt this when I was in Sydney. You know, you walk through Sydney, it's this like, it's a metropolis as such. It's like this heavy industrial era kind of city, big buildings. And then you see the Australian flag and the Aboriginal flag flying side by side and the land acknowledgements. But then you think it has to go further than this, no? But then I think this is where we reach a really challenging impasse, because this is where we get to power. And how, like even in the US, for example, the question of land back, how do we get to a place where one would feel such a great responsibility that they would understand that we absolutely need to redefine our understanding of what does it mean to live on the land without owning it? And and especially now in the 21st century, how to live together after the violence, the abject violence that we have inflicted on one another. So,
yeah. So Gustavo has a bunch of questions about what the future could look like. And one thing I want to say, just for clarity's sake, I don't think anyone would think I'm saying something otherwise, but it's climate instability is a fact, right? What I'm trying to say is that that then has allowed things like resilient discourse to become a mode of governance. So it's right. So I think, how do you start imagining the future? Well, one way might be to critically start to question things like resilience, right? What does it mean for a mode of thinking that wants us to live as if in perpetual risk forever, right? So I think you can start thinking, well, what if there's space beyond the risk that we obviously face, right? What if we take that little sliver of energy and space and start to think of other modes of living?
Absolutely. And I think Gustavo is also just had this question that, you know, how can, you know, technology has limits. And I would have to absolutely agree with you. Sometimes I think, you know, I understand that technology is like a really easy way for us to all to connect because we're all connected through it by proxy. But I think it repeats the same dilemma that we've been caught in, which is, oh, you can't imagine a life outside of capitalism because you're too busy surviving it. Right. And I think it's about so these, all of these questions are in play, frankly. Everything is in play right now.
Yeah.
Just depends on who's going to do what. Go on, sorry.
No, I was going to say, and also there's, there's this constant demand on us to learn how to survive better. State no longer has to take care of us. But, you know, those are some tools that we are generating, right? We common folks. So that might be a space too where what if we don't turn all these tools that we're being forced to build for ourselves, what if we don't turn that back in the service of the state or the status quo and figure out how to build things beyond that space with these tools that they're making us develop anyways.
Yeah, so true. As Noah also says,
what is it?
Noah is like also saying so true. And Gustavo just made a great comment that resilience is a word made for those in power that want to pass along the pain to others. I've seen this in the context of Gaza right now. People are like, it's not enough to just call us resilient. We want to live. It was the same in the COVID crisis with the NHS workers in the UK. They were like, it's not enough to just clap us. You need to pay us a living wage.
Right.
So, you know, these are all things that are, it's all the scaffolding that keeps things in place, really. We're coming up to an hour, so I just want to make sure that anyone who has any questions can get them in. Or, again, comments. These comments are really, Gustavo, thank you for being so active. They were really great comments that you've made. And everyone else as well. I don't know, Jean, do you have any thoughts on Oh, Gustavo says, let's all unite together. Our fragmentation is our opportunity for change. We only need to be together for a moment to make change. Well, yeah, too. I have hope, too. Let's see.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's a lot to walk away with from this conversation and ponder through. I think we got a lot on the table. Hopefully fruitfully for us and for other folks.
Wonderful. Yeah. We're ride or die for a better world.
That's right.
Okay, well, I think that's good. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Thank you so much to Art Papers, to Sarah, Noah, Michael, the team, everything that you do. Jean, thank you so much for being with me today in this conversation. Super. And I think that's it, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Until the next time.
And I want to thank you for moderating and taken over. I know that was supposed to be my task, but
no worries.
A little bit media illiterate, so that's fine.
Yeah, that's
so thank
okay.
You for that too.
It got me to work the live for the first time, so I guess my horizons have been expanded as well.
Super.
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, thank you, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.